You are listening to the Horse Radio Network, part of the Equine Network family.
Hello and welcome to this episode of the Disease du Jour podcast. I'm your host, Carly Sisson, and in this episode, I spoke with Dr. Alan Page about his research on the metabolic effects of intra-articular corticosteroids. This episode of Disease du Jour is brought to you by Equithrive. Dr. Page is an assistant professor in the Department of Veterinary Science at the University of Kentucky's Maxwell H. Gluck Equine Research Center. He received both his Bachelor of Science and Doctor of Veterinary Medicine from the University of California, Davis, before moving to Lexington to complete a rotating internship at the Haggard Equine Medical Institute and a PhD at the University of Kentucky. His research interests include the inflammatory response to exercise and injury in equine athletes across a variety of disciplines, as well as the effects of various intra-articular corticosteroids and their potentially adverse metabolic effects. He also has an interest in developing diagnostics for various infectious diseases based on mRNA expression analysis and/or serum antibody detection. Thank you, Dr. Page, for joining us.
Sure, absolutely. Happy to be here.
Can you start out by giving us a little bit of an overview about your research focus, specifically as it relates to intra-articular corticosteroids?
Yeah, absolutely. So the work we've been doing with corticosteroids now has been going on for almost 5 years. The first project we did came from my very first master's students. And the goal of that project really wasn't anywhere in the endocrine or metabolic space. It was actually trying to determine how long some of these corticosteroids that we put into horse joints, how long they last. So we looked at triamcinolone, we looked at betamethasone, and then those horses were also injected with saline. So those horses got all three treatments, they were spread out. And then we would come back 14 days after that injection and elicit an inflammatory response in the joint. And so we were able to compare how they responded following each of those treatments. And what we found is even 14 days later, triamcinolone still had a significant anti-inflammatory effect. And those horses still had inflammation and were lame, but it was just to a much lower degree than the betamethasone and the saline treatments. So we knew that triamcinolone was still having an effect. What we also did in that project was we also sampled them for cortisol. Now, a lot of people have already looked at cortisol with these different steroids. There was nothing novel there, other than the fact that we were looking at it in all three of the treatments across those same horses. And we saw, you see a really profound suppression of cortisol. In fact, there were several time points in the horses that received triamcinolone where they had non-detectable cortisol. We've always kind of thought of high cortisol as being bad. You know, that's, we see diseases like pituitary pars intermedia dysfunction that has high cortisol and ACTH as well. And we also know that high cortisol can be immunosuppressive, but nobody's ever really figured out if low cortisol, especially if it lasts for a couple of days, can be detrimental. But it got us thinking about, okay, maybe we should focus more on the metabolic effects of these drugs. And it was around that same time that two other groups started working on that. So there's work that came out about a year later from Michigan State that looked at triamcinolone and its effects on insulin and glucose, and as did North Carolina State University. They put out some work. So that led us then to our next project, because that work had just come out from the other groups. So we were looking at some novel aspects of this area, and we did what we call our ProStride project. So this was a project where we compared the metabolic effects of triamcinolone injected into a front one single fetlock joint versus ProStride, which is a commercially available orthobiologic product. You get the kits, Zoetis distributes them here in the U.S., and then use the horse's own blood to process those samples and obtain the anti-inflammatory proteins. And then, of course, we compared it to saline again. And what we found was, not surprisingly, triamcinolone still has a fairly significant metabolic effect that can last upwards of a week or so, but ProStride didn't. And so that kind of led us to that conclusion, if you have a horse with some endocrine or metabolic diseases or concerns, maybe an orthobiologic like ProStride would be more appropriate. What was also interesting about that project is that we went beyond the typical 72 hours of sampling that the other projects have done. So we did once a day for 7 days, and then we also got a 14-day sample. And having that longer time period was important because it actually showed us that some horses that receive triamcinolone have hyperinsulinemia, so kind of above our normal cutoff, going out to 7 days. And when we think about that in the context of potentially insulin dysregulated horses or horses that are at risk for laminitis caused by high insulin, that's very much a concern. So that then we felt we were onto something. So then we have repeated some of those metabolic studies. We did a project with betamethasone, another one of the popular intra-articular steroids that we use in equine practice. That is typically considered more of a weaker corticosteroid than triamcinolone. And unfortunately, in that project, our insulin data was underpowered. So we can't really make strong statistical conclusions about what effect betamethasone has on insulin. We did find that when it came to glucose, that glucose shows a similar time course or effect that we see with triamcinolone. So it suggested to us maybe if we had more horses, we would have seen something with insulin. What's also interesting about that project is we, for the first time, actually injected 3 insulin dysregulated horses to see if they would respond differently. And they didn't. Again, that was underpowered, not surprising because of the small group. But it showed us that, you know, this is something we could certainly look at. And the work's just continued from there. So we had a project that we published late last year with methylprednisolone acetate, another one of those top steroids that we use. It is a drug that by and large is used in low motion joints because there's research out there to suggest that it can be damaging to high motion joint cartilage. So typically used in things like the lower hock joints that don't move very much. And that's what we did there. So we utilized a low dose on the lower end of what most practitioners will use. That was 20 milligrams per joint. So total of 80 milligrams into a horse. And did not find any effects of methylpred on either insulin or glucose. So that was good to see. It did transiently impact ACTH and cortisol, but we would kind of expected that. It was not anywhere near as pronounced as some of the previous work, though, that used typically larger doses. So that was interesting to us. And I think we can maybe talk about it more in a bit, but it matched with some of the practitioner sentiment that's out there as far as MPA maybe being a little bit safer, if you will, and having less of a risk factor for laminitis. And then the last one that has just come out in February, I think is really cool, kind of culmination of this. And that's our work with atirgliflozin. So atirgliflozin is a sodium glucose-like transporter 2 inhibitor. It works to increase glucose excretion in the kidney. It does that by blocking glucose reabsorption that takes place in the kidney. So you get rid of glucose, and then that then lowers the trigger, if you will, for the body to produce insulin. So those drugs are being used pretty regularly these days in horses with insulin dysregulation, especially those at risk for laminitis. And there's at least one company working on probably a commercially available drug for horses that hopefully they'll be coming out in the next couple of years. But with this study, what we did was we pre-treated horses with atirgliflozin for 7 days because we didn't know how long it would take to get an effective concentration in the blood and circulation. So we pre-treated for them for 7 days, and then they received a triamcinolone injection. So we gave a pretty high dose of 18 milligrams total. And then we continued that treatment for 7 days after the injection. And we found that it significantly decreased the hyperinsulinemic and hypoglycemic responses. So increased insulin and glucose responses we get following that drug. They still did increase, but not nearly as much. So pretty exciting that you can do that. Now, all of these studies, with the exception of that betamethasone one, have been done in metabolically normal horses, but we've always seen them as kind of a first step, if you will, towards exploring a lot of these different questions in insulin dysregulated horses. And that's what we've been doing, I guess, over the last 4 or 5 years now.
Yeah, that's a really impressive scope, especially over just such a short time period. And looking forward to going into some of these studies in a little bit more detail here. This podcast is brought to you by Equithrive. Breeding places a unique and time-sensitive demand on the mare's body. Following breeding, a healthy uterine immune response and timely return to balance are essential for creating an optimal environment for conception and early pregnancy. University studies show that Equithrive mare pellets support post-breeding uterine immune balance and inflammatory resolution during the most critical stages of the breeding cycle. Do you have a problem mare? Learn more about the science behind Equithrive mare pellets by clicking the link in the description or visiting equithrive.com. Across all of the research you've done, what are some of the patterns that have emerged and how the different corticosteroids affects horses' insulin and glucose dynamics? I know you touched on that just now, but you know, maybe just break that down a little bit more specifically for us.
Sure. I think it's pretty clear. So we generally in equine practice from an intra-articular or joint medication standpoint are going to be talking about triamcinolone acetonide, betamethasone esters, or methylprednisolone acetate. So those are going to be the three most used. Obviously, when it comes down to more systemic reactions, we might use dexamethasone and some others systemically. So, but if we're talking about just the three that are geared towards joint inflammation, triamcinolone is clearly the strongest and the most impactful from a metabolic standpoint. We've seen that now across multiple studies of ours. I mentioned the ones that have come out, the work from others as well. I don't know how much we can really extrapolate from betamethasone and methylprednisolone at this point. I'm pretty confident in the results we got from the methylprednisolone. Now, admittedly, again, that was a pretty low dose. Certainly recognize that practitioners may use a higher dose, either per joint or a total body dose. The betamethasone, again, since that was an underpowered study, we really can't make a whole lot of comments on that one. Other than going back to that original work, which we know betamethasone doesn't really have, you know, a substantial anti-inflammatory effect when we're talking about 14 days after it's been injected. So, but again, as I kind of hit on here at the end of that last question, these are all metabolically normal horses. And so it's really difficult to extrapolate to insulin dysregulated horses currently, since that's the group we're going to be worried about. You know, do they either respond differently to the steroids? Do they maybe develop a more intense or maybe even less intense insulin response after these drugs? We really don't know. I know there's work going on by others. We'd certainly like to explore this more as well. So I'm sure we'll get those answers in the, you know, in the next year or so. It's definitely a growing area of research interest across a variety of different groups. So I'm sure we'll get some good data soon.
Yeah. So given what we currently know and don't know about how these drugs are going to impact metabolically challenged horses, how do you think that these differences should factor into a veterinarian's decision-making when selecting an agent, or should they at this point?
Oh, this is a good question. So I feel like at this point, there's enough data out there from a risk standpoint. So taking a step back, so the work we've done, again, the work that others have done, we have survey data from horses that developed laminitis showing a correlation between the administration of corticosteroids and those laminitis episodes. So I think we're all pretty confident at this point that intra-articular steroids are not without risk, especially in those horses that are insulin dysregulated. So as a practitioner, we need to balance those risks. I feel like I'm obviously not in practice. If I was, I would be to the point now where I'd either be requiring my patients to undergo, you know, point of care testing for insulin. These are things that are very easy to carry in a truck these days, and you get results within minutes. You know, as a insurance policy, if you will, to see if these horses are insulin dysregulated, and then obviously that would require a pretty big rethink on our plans. At the very least, vets should be offering this to owners. If owners want to decline, that's their prerogative, but then we should very much be documenting that. So if they do develop laminitis in that near term after the corticosteroids, at least that's been offered. I would personally say I would not be putting triamcinolone in a horse that I am concerned, regardless of that testing. If I was concerned about a horse being insulin dysregulated, I would think long and hard about putting triamcinolone in them. Depending on the joint, I mean, again, we just don't have enough data to really say that one of these drugs is safe. I think maybe we'll get there, or maybe we'll come up with some other management ideas. But I think we also need to keep in mind, you know, the work that we did comparing triamcinolone to ProStride. We know that ProStride, you know, an orthobiologic, does not elicit a metabolic response that would be of concern to these horses. So if we're trying to treat a condition that we feel like would be amenable to an orthobiologic, that's probably what we should be reaching for, even though there's obviously going to be an increased cost long term. You know, if we weigh the cost of that treatment, the orthobiologic, versus the cost and obviously the significant welfare concerns of potentially developing laminitis, I feel like the orthobiologic wins out in that instance. So I think that's how I would come at it at this point. And hopefully that helps practitioners. And again, I think we'll have a lot more information. We'll be able to give them a lot more sound, peer-reviewed guidance here in the near future.
Yeah, that's great advice, especially now that we have so many other options that we can reach for that might be a little bit safer in some of these horses. So what has your research uncovered about how intra-articular injections impact metabolic testing and the interpretation of those results?
So we specifically looked at that in that ProStride versus triamcinolone project and have subsequently dialed back what we're doing. So in that project, we ran a regular oral sugar test. So oral sugar test is a pretty easy way for veterinarians to diagnose horses as having insulin dysregulation. You get a blood sample, you give them K-Row syrup. It's pretty substantial volume for most adult horses. It's between about 80 and 100 microliter, 100 milliliters. So, you know, two essentially oral syringefuls almost. And then you give that and then you collect a blood sample 60 minutes later and you see 60 or 90 minutes later, you can do either or. And you want to see then if their insulin goes above, generally we say 45 internationally or micro international unit. So that's how we do that. So that's a dynamic test for insulin dysregulation. We also in that project looked at the thyrotropin releasing hormone test. So that's a test you can do to diagnose horses with PPID or Cushing's disease. We used to do the dexamethasone suppression test. Depending on the time of year, you can do just a resting ACTH. But with that TRH stimulation, you get a blood sample, you give 1 milligram of thyrotropin releasing hormone IV. It's just a standard dose across all horses. And you come back exactly 10 minutes later and you look for how much that ACTH level increased. Again, that's very seasonal and how you interpret that. So in that ProStride project, we did both. We did both of those things. And what we found is that day two after the triamcinolone, there was a significant impact on both the oral sugar test and the thyrotropin releasing hormone test. The effect on the TRH was because ACTH was suppressed in that initial sample, but it remained pretty low even after the TRH test. Oral sugar test is exactly opposite. They tend to have a more exaggerated response to that oral sugar test. The results had gone back to normal by 7 days in that group. But again, we had some horses that still had some resting insulin levels that would be significant and suggestive of them being insulin dysregulated. So generally, my takeaway is you shouldn't do any of these metabolic tests for at least 7 days after a steroid injection. 14 days would probably be a better option. The other option is to, of course, do it if you know you're going to want to do some of this testing, you know, but you also know you're going to be injecting these horses. For the reasons we were just talking about a minute ago, we should probably be doing that testing ahead of time.
Right.
And then subsequently come back with the steroids. Now, in the test that the studies we've done after the ProStride test, when we looked at methylprednisolone acetate, there was no real effect of that on our oral sugar test. And like I said, with betamethasone, because it was underpowered, we can't really say much about insulin. Not a huge response, at least when we looked at it in that oral sugar test. So it seems again like triamcinolone is the stronger and more potent steroid that we really need to keep an eye on, especially when it comes to some of these dynamic metabolic tests.
Yeah, that's so interesting. But again, I guess if we're testing these horses beforehand, then you know, we can hopefully avoid that issue.
Absolutely. Yeah, that should always be the goal.
Yep. So I'd love to learn more now about some of the research you've done on artoglyphosin. And I'm sorry if I'm pronouncing that incorrectly. That word is challenging for me.
You should try spelling it. It's even more fun.
So what have you learned about how that drug influences horses' metabolic response to steroids?
Yeah, that was a really fun and fascinating project because we really didn't know what we were going to find. So nobody's done this before. So this artoglyphosin project, again, the goal was to pre-treat these horses for 7 days. And that's because we don't really have any pharmacokinetic data in horses to say, you know, it takes X number of doses once a day to start having an effect. So we said, okay, in humans, it's thought to take 5 days to get to a steady state concentration. Let's do 7 to just make sure we get where we need to be. So we pre-treated them for 7 days, and then for the following 7 days after their joint injection. And this was a crossover study. So we had the horses either receive triamcinolone by itself without any treatment with atirgliflozin, or in the subsequent injection period, they received the atirgliflozin treatment and the triamcinolone. So we didn't have any saline in here. But what we found is that pre-treatment and subsequent treatment after the fact with atirgliflozin significantly decreased the insulin and glucose responses in these horses. So they still did have a spike, and it was the typical timing that we see when they weren't treated. Usually where it peaks around 48 hours or so, usually decreasing by 72. So it looked the same. But the average value for this group and also some of the maximums were lower than what we saw with just the triamcinolone only treatment. So that suggested to us that there is some potential to use this drug and potentially even the entire class of drugs as a way to help decrease that hyperinsulinemia that we can get after these steroids. Again, the caveat here being that these are metabolically normal horses. So again, does an ID horse respond the same way? I don't know. There are some other management opportunities for ID horses to maybe decrease their risk as well. So maybe we don't necessarily want to reach for a drug right off the bat. Again, maybe more prudent use of the orthobiologics. Maybe we think about, you know, weight loss and you know, dietary restriction, changing how many non-structural carbohydrates they get. That sort of thing would be a better option than just going straight to atirgliflozin. But knowing that it might be an option still is a good step forward.
Yeah. Are there any adverse effects or contraindications that veterinarians should be aware of, or any horses in which it would or wouldn't be warranted?
So I'd say at this point, we have an okay understanding of the side effects. I think as these drugs are used more and more, it wouldn't surprise me if there are some unusual side effects that come out. By and large, though, the side effects that have been reported primarily in insulin dysregulated horses would be triglyceridemia or high triglycerides in the circulation, and they can get pretty high. And the concern with that is if they get really high, you can develop fatty liver, and that then causes a whole host of other problems for the horse. So we want to avoid that. So typically the recommendation is that insulin dysregulated horses that are on an SGLT2 inhibitor are monitored on a regular basis, at least weekly when they're first starting, and then see how they respond to make sure that they're not developing that. If they do, or if they're starting to get high enough that somebody is concerned, usually you cut their dose in half and then keep monitoring them. Maybe they'll respond to that half dose. Maybe you just keep them on the half dose for a little while and then you can bump them up. But keeping an eye on that is by far and away going to be the most concerning side effect of these drugs. Some of the other more common reported side effects would be increased water intake and increased urination. So what we call polyuria, polydipsia. And the thought there being glucose is itself a diuretic. So if it is in the urine, it will very likely pull other free fluid with it. And that then will decrease the amount of fluid that's available in circulation. And so the horses will drink to try to compensate for that. So I think that's a big aspect, and probably the biggest ones we need to be considering from a side effect standpoint. I think the other word of caution I have is, we've been using these drugs, the SGLT2 inhibitors, you know, on an increasing basis in practice. And so while we're confident that they do help these ID horses lower their insulin, we don't have any data right now to support their use as a way to prevent laminitis in the context of these steroid-associated laminitis, which is still a hyperinsulinemia-associated laminitis. We don't have that data yet. Maybe we get there eventually. Maybe we have enough data that kind of dances around it that we can make that comment, but we still have a little ways to go. So that's my word of caution. The scientist in me thinks that we still probably need a little bit more data before we can make that leap.
Right. Even lacking some of this data, if a vet were to use an SGLT2 inhibitor in accordance with an IA injection, what would the timing look like for that?
Oh, that's a good question. So again, so we use that 7 days pre-treatment and 7 days post-treatment. We ran a pharmacokinetic study, and I guess I should also mention that I didn't mention from the beginning. We used a compounded eteraglifloson.
Right.
There is no FDA-approved SGLT2 inhibitor for horses. There are several for humans, and so we're using one version. I think work that's going on by others is using a different version, and then even then, the one that'll be used in veterinary medicine is another one entirely. But again, all in that same class. So we use a compounded eteraglifloson, and we wanted to get a better idea about the pharmacokinetics of that. So we actually, as part of this study, did run a small PK aspect to that. I'm hoping we'll get that out here in the near future. I'll just say we were surprised at how quickly it reached its maximum concentrations. And I think if we move forward with some of this work, we won't be doing that 7 day pretreatment. It very likely is not necessary. I suspect we'll be in that 0 to 2 days of pretreatment. I still think we'd be going out to 7 days post-treatment, just based on the data that we've seen previously and the fact that you can have some horses remain with really high insulin levels out to at least 7 days. My suspicion is we'd probably want to treat them that long. So not. And that should be relatively cost effective, would be my hope, especially when we balance again the cost of treating laminitis and the welfare concerns that go along with it.
Yep. Yeah, that's great. What are some research questions that you hope to address moving forward with some of your work?
Yeah, I mean, I think the biggest one, right? And I've hit on it a bunch of times with all these words of caution is we need to do this work in insulin dysregulated horses.
Yep.
I think my group, I'll speak for my group. I'm assuming it's the same for the other groups that are working on this. We've all been really hesitant to move this work into insulin dysregulated horses because we know there is that significantly elevated risk of laminitis. But we also know that's really the target demographic for a lot of the work we're doing. So I think, my goal, my hope is whether it's us, whether it's these other groups, we'll start to do this work in a controlled fashion with insulin dysregulated horses. We're lucky here in our department. We have several groups of these insulin dysregulated horses that we can use and work with on a research basis. So again, hopefully some of that data will be coming out soon. I think one of the limitations for the work that we've had has been, it's not really a limitation, it's a conscious study design effort is, and we talk about the methylprednisolone study. So where we used 20 milligrams per joint, so 80 milligrams total. There are other vets out there that will probably use 40 to 50 milligrams per joint. So they'll get up to 160 to 200 milligrams total body dose, right? There's no right or wrong choice when we're doing this work. We kind of have to pick a starting point and go from there. So whether some of this work translates to different doses, whether some of this work translates to different joints, is another question, right? Joint size, joint volume may play a role in the way that these drugs are absorbed and have their systemic effects. I don't know. I think there's a lot of opportunity again to explore that in a controlled manner to get a better idea about that.
Yeah, that's such a good point. Where can our listeners find your work or follow some of your future research?
So the Glucky Coin Research Center has a Facebook page. We try to post some of our manuscripts or at least abstracts on there. That's usually a pretty good spot. The university does maintain some faculty pages, and that usually gets updated with different citations as they come out. And certainly, I think we plan to be more upfront. We plan to be a little bit more active and posting this data as it comes out because we recognize that there are owners, there are veterinarians that want to have this data. And my goal and my group, I'm a veterinarian and I have a PhD. So my goal has always been to put forth clinically relevant, impactful research that can be immediately translated out into practice. And so my hope is to keep doing that. And so, looking at those different avenues is probably going to be the best way. We obviously go and we talk at the different meetings like the AAP annual convention when we have data to share as well. So pretty common for us to be speaking at one of those. But yeah, so a variety of different ways that people can find out about this work.
Awesome. Well, I'm really looking forward to, continuing to follow as you look at more horses and, see all the effects of these steroids because this is such an impactful project that you've taken on.
Yeah, it's been we've been pleasantly surprised at getting the results we have, and it's really instilled in us the importance of keeping it moving forward to, again, to help owners, to help equine vets as they deal with these real world challenges that I think are just going to become more and more frequent. So giving them the information they need is really critical.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much, Dr. Page, for joining us on this episode. I really appreciate having you on to talk about your work.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Yeah, of course. I would like to say thank you again to Dr. Page for joining us, and thank you to Equithrive for supporting this episode. And as always, thank you to everyone who listens to Disease Du Jour. If you have any questions or suggestions for the podcast, please email me at csisson@equinenetwork.com.